This is a CBC podcast.
Hi there, I'm David Cochrane, and this is the Power and Politics podcast for Friday, April 5th. Liberal MP Anthony Housefather is staying in the Liberal caucus. Just ahead, he's here to explain his decision after 2 weeks of reflection. And Israel reopened some aid routes into Gaza after the U.S. demanded it protect civilians or risk losing support. Coming up, Canada's former ambassador to Israel on whether Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is listening. Plus, hours of testimony at the inquiry into foreign interference this week will take you through all the big revelations. We begin with that breaking news that Liberal MP Anthony Housefather says he'll stay in the Liberal caucus. Just 2 weeks ago, he said he needed time to reflect after the government voted in favor of a motion on Palestinian statehood, a vote that Housefather called a huge slap in the face to Canada's Jewish community. Liberal MP Anthony Housefather joins me now. Mr. Housefather, it's good to speak with you again. Thanks for taking the time.
Good to speak with you too, David.
I wonder if you could tell me exactly when you made this decision. Now, you've been reflecting for several weeks. When did you decide you were a Liberal to stay?
I have been reflecting and thinking about it very hard, and I really only made the decision in the last day or so. I had some extensive conversations with the Prime Minister over the last 3 days, and one of the things that we talked about, in fact, the thing that we talked the most about, was the fear and intimidation felt by Jewish Canadians, whether related to the demonstrations outside of Jewish community buildings and businesses, or alternatively, what's happening on college campuses. And I really had very, very painful discussions where we talked about what I felt was not enough action by the government. And he said, come work with me, come work with Deborah Lyons, play a leadership role on this file, and we will fix it. And I believe that if I'm involved, I will make a difference. I will work very, very hard with Deborah and the Prime Minister and others to make a meaningful difference for Jewish Canadians, because I think anti-Semitism on Canada is a problem for everyone. It's a national security issue. It's an issue, a threat to our democracy. And more important, it could happen to any group here. So that was really what put me over the tipping point. It was the commitment to a meaningful leadership role in anti-Semitism where the government will really act.
Right.
And of course, oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, so Deborah Lyons is a special envoy on combating anti-Semitism. And I just wonder if you could give us some more specifics on that. Like what extra actions are we going to see from your government on this? Because the Jewish community, as you well know, has been frustrated with the federal government's response to this. They've been criticized by this by the conservatives. So what fundamentally do you expect to see change in a way that makes you comfortable with your decision?
Again, I will be involved in developing an action plan with Deborah, and I will come back to you and tell you exactly what that is, but I can give you some specifics. I think when it comes to IRA, we need to get a handbook out to explain how to implement IRA, and we need to get universities across the country to deal with the anti-Semitism on university campuses. We need to make sure that codes of conduct are up to snuff. I want to encourage them to adopt the IRA definition of anti-Semitism. I mean, there's all kinds of things related to locations of demonstrations on campus that can make students feel safer. I am going to, and I can tell you, look at the issues right there. My city, in my municipalities of Hampstead and Cook St. Luke, are adopting resolutions like Vaughan, I believe, in Ontario has, that say you need to have a protected space between buildings and demonstrators. All of these things, education of police, all of these things are things that we can work on, roll out, and make things better for people, even if it's not within our jurisdiction. Deborah and I and others can use our bully pulpit to bring people together and to give them offers of solutions. So to me, there's a lot of work that can be done, and I'm going to roll up my sleeves and get that done, because that can't wait 18 months. That has to happen now.
Okay, IRA, for people at home, is the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, if I'm remembering that acronym correctly, so people know. So it's that definition you want to be adopted and implemented and followed and recognized in a way to reduce the insecurity and the threats and the fear that Jewish Canadians are feeling across the country and feeling on university campuses in particular. So you say you've spoken with the Prime Minister. I have to ask, Mr. Housefather, because it's felt like the Conservatives were making overtures to you, and there was a lot of suggestions that you had been speaking with them. Did you speak with other parties about possibly joining them, the Conservatives in particular, as you were reflecting?
Look, I'm not going to reveal private discussions. As I said, I was considering all options. And again, I have lots of friends in the Conservative caucus. But, you know, in the end, I made a decision. It wasn't like this was an easy decision, because that vote was deeply painful to me and many members of my community. As I explained in the statement that I issued today, I didn't come to this decision easily. But I also, David, heard from Canadians across the country, many of whom were liberals who were slightly disaffected, who were centrist voices in the party. And they said, if you leave, what is going to happen to centrist voices in the party? What is going to happen to voices that stand by the United States and stand by Western democracies and stand by countries like Israel against threats and autocratic nations like Iran? And their proxies, Hamas and Hezbollah. Who's going to stand for fiscal responsibility? Who's going to stand for a strong charter of rights and a strong national government that stands up to provinces when they invoke the notwithstanding clause preemptively? And I reflected on that, and I believe that my voice as a centrist is also important in the Liberal Party, and I don't want to abandon that space.
Okay, in your statement, you outline many of the issues that are core to the Liberals' identity and that the values that you share with them. But there is still this disagreement on the foreign policy approach to the conflict in the Middle East and this government's approach to dealing with Israel. That's not going away. So this position, this decision you've taken, like, is this tenable for the long term? Because we saw President Biden, for example, take a tougher line with Israel this week. I don't suspect Melanie Jolie is going to get any softer in her critique of the way the Israeli government is conducting this conflict. I mean, how comfortable are you with what living with this position? Should they take other positions on a foreign policy level that you don't agree with when it comes to Israel?
Well, again, I think if I leave, where are the pro-Israel voices in the Liberal Party? I need to be there to lead along with Marco Mendicino and Ben Carr and others, to make clear that the Liberal Party, which is a strong national governing party and has people from representing all Canadians, well, the Canadians that agree with me need to be represented too. And, you know, I don't think that it's blind agreement with the Israeli government that anyone is calling for. Mm-hmm. I can have disagreements with Prime Minister Netanyahu. I can have disagreements with ways that Israel may be conducting the war. That's a very different thing than the motion that the NDP originally proposed before the House. And so I will fight for my vision. I will use my bully pulpit, and I will be in caucus and fight for the positions that I hold dear. And it's not only about foreign policy in Israel. It's about other things too. I believe in, for example, meeting NATO commitments and a strong armed forces. I mean, there's a lot more to this whole issue, including foreign policy, than just Israel.
No, understood. But when you outline these things, they're not necessarily positions I would associate with the core values of the cabinet. I'm not saying they don't support Western democracies, but like hitting the NATO target, for instance, you know, the fiscal responsibilities bent that you talk about, this is a government that likes to spend. I just wonder, when you outline the reasons why you feel you need to stay, because if you leave, there's no voice on those issues in the caucus. Should we take that to mean you don't think those are necessarily there in sufficient mass? They're not there in the cabinet? How should we interpret that?
I think you should interpret it by the fact that I have deep core beliefs as to what the Liberal Party should be, and that I believe that my place is now there fighting for those values. I thought about it long and hard. I thought about, does my voice still matter in the party, or should I abandon the space and just leave? And I was really touched by the detailed emails I received from literally thousands of people outside of my riding that talked about their viewpoint as liberals and asked me to stay and fight for the kind of values that we shared. And so I am going to do that, and I'm not going to be shy about it. And if I don't agree with things, I will say so. But for me, the Liberal Party has to be a centrist party. It cannot be the NDP light. It has to be a centrist party that speaks to Canadians on the left of center, and even to some extent on the right of center. I'm an unapologetically proud Canadian, and I don't want to be ashamed of that. I want to fight for those values in the Liberal Party.
I have to just come back, though, to the issue of Israel. And I know that is, you are about more than that issue, but that is a very important issue right now. And it is one that has force you into this very public period of difficult reflection. And, you know, to circle back to where I was earlier, this is not an issue that appears like it's going to go away anytime soon. So how confident are you that having made this decision today, that you're going to be able to live with whatever choices your government makes when it comes to the Israeli government and this particular conflict in the coming weeks and months?
Look, I can only say that I will be there fighting for the values that I hold dear. I can't pretend to say that everything that the government will do will be something that I'll agree with, but at least I'll have my voice at the table at a time when the Liberal Party is in power. And that's a really important thing, because if my voice is not there, you know, that's taking away a pro-Israel voice from the party that's in power. And so I would say, though, David, that again, this is, I think, a much broader issue than Israel. Mm-hmm. I think it's an entire vision of how foreign policy is conducted. And I think that the motion that was adopted, to me, unfortunately, rewards Iran and Hamas and Hezbollah over Israel. And I don't think that was in anybody's best interest. I think the government amendments made it far better, but the initial motion was absolutely terrible.
So just as a final point, you say you made this decision in the last number of hours, last couple of days, after intensive conversations with the prime minister. Is it those conversations with Justin Trudeau that convinced you to stay? And how close were you to leaving?
Like I said, I was going back and forth in my head as to whether or not my voice still mattered in the party. And yes, the direct conversations with the prime minister, with the deputy prime minister, made a significant difference. When Justin Trudeau and Chrystia Freeland take the time to speak to you at length, it certainly made a difference. And I really feel that there is a real commitment to making fighting anti-Semitism one of the most important goals of the government. And that, to me, because my Jewish community, although I represent everyone, not just Jews, my Jewish community and Jews across Canada are very scared and very intimidated. That was a meaningful thing to me, and I want to be part of that work.
And were you thinking, just as a last question, were you weighing between sitting as an independent or joining another party?
I was weighing all options, like I said from the beginning. I thought about everything, but I don't believe an independent has much value in our system. I wish it did. I wish independents had more power in the Canadian political system. But right now, unfortunately, you can't speak in the House without permission. You can't be on committees. It's not really a tenable thing that gives the best to your constituents.
Okay, so it was either Liberals or Conservatives, it sounds like.
Well, again, I considered all options, but one rejected because it wasn't a good option for my constituents.
Okay. Liberal MP Anthony Housefather, thank you for joining us today, sir.
Thank you very much, David.
Well, sticking with this, Israel has released the findings of their inquiry into the deadly strike on aid workers in Gaza earlier this week.
This incident has been thoroughly investigated, and the findings show that this strike was carried out due to a misidentification at night during a war under very complex conditions. As a result, two senior military officers have already been dismissed from their posts.
The United States has been putting pressure on Israel in recent days to take concrete and measurable steps to protect civilians in Gaza, saying they want results.
So we'll be looking at all of this in the days to come, and we'll be, as I said, assessing fully the report on the World Central Kitchen incident, and looking to see not just what steps are being taken, but the results that follow from them.
John Allen is the former Canadian ambassador to Israel, and he joins me now. John Allen, it's good to have you back on the show.
Hi, David. Thanks very much.
Let's start with your big picture assessment of where things stand right now with this shift by the United States to sort of hinge future support to change by how Benjamin Netanyahu is conducting this war and the response we've seen so far. What's your sense of where things stand at this moment?
Well, clearly this, unlike the other 200 aid workers that have been killed, has taken the situation to a completely other level, in part because there were so many nationals that were killed, in part because of the nature of the way these people were killed after having advised the Israelis ahead of time, et cetera, et cetera. So the pressure is really now being put on Bibi Netanyahu and his war cabinet really at three levels. One, on the humanitarian side, a real push now to open crossings, and not just open crossings, but to get the food and the medical supplies, et cetera, in. The other is to try and force both sides, frankly, very difficult, but both sides to move to a ceasefire. And then there is still the remaining question of Rafah, which the Americans keep asking the Israelis about. They want to know their plan. So these three things are on the table, and I think the pressure is on Bibi to deliver on all of them in a way.
I want to talk about those in more depth, but I want to start with what they've delivered essentially in terms of an explanation and as a consequence for the strike that killed the seven people working with World Central Kitchen. They've essentially done a quick investigation. They have fired, dismissed two military officers, demoted two more. How do you evaluate that? Do you think that's going to be enough?
Well, I think the chef and others are demanding an open, transparent, and perhaps an investigation not just by the Israeli military. I don't think they're going to get that. They may get and should get a much more comprehensive and detailed investigation, not just something that came up over the last 2 days. And of course, there's going to be questions of compensation and, you know, trying to make sure it never happens again. So we've had a first step and only a first step. We'll have to see what flows. But I don't think we're going to see independent investigators coming into Israel to look at this.
We've heard from Prime Minister Trudeau on this. He said earlier this week it wasn't okay for Netanyahu to just categorize these deaths as something that happens in war. We've seen Anthony Blinken, the U.S. Secretary of State, saying that the U.S. will be assessing fully the report. It doesn't seem like the verbal response and the procedural response has totally calmed anything, certainly with the two big players here on this continent.
I agree. And there are foreign nationals killed in a number of countries, and I'm sure none of the leaders are happy with that. Yes, these things do happen in war, but this one was so outrageous in the sense that so much information was provided ahead of time. I don't think it was intentional. I really don't, but it was a horrible mistake, and it just reflects the huge issues that refusing to let more humanitarian aid pose. And that's why everybody is saying, let the trucks in, and you won't have to have an NGO delivering 2 million meals to people that are starving.
Yeah, we have seen the U.S. call for Israel to change its ways before, but never sort of with the specter of immediate consequences if there wasn't an immediate change. So I wonder how important that is, your sense, in how Netanyahu responds, coupled, John, with what we've seen from Benny Gantz saying there needs to be early elections in Israel, maybe as early as September, to sort of, you know, restore trust, I guess, inside Israel in the direction of the country, in the direction of the way they're conducting the war. I mean, how do those external pressures and internal pressures affect things for Bibi Netanyahu right now?
Well, the external pressures are really related to if he doesn't react in the way that the Americans want, what are they going to do? Are they going to slow walk ammunition and weapons? Given what's recently happened in terms of the strike against the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps and the generals killed, you've still got Hezbollah rockets coming into the north. The Americans are going to be reluctant to cut Israel off completely, but they could be sending signals by slow walking that. On the question of Benny Gantz, clearly he is signaling that he may be almost ready to pull out of the war cabinet, that he doesn't trust Bibi. He doesn't trust that he's prosecuting this war in the interests of the Israeli people. Rather, he's doing it in his own interests. And he, like Chuck Schumer, is basically saying, let the Israeli people speak, and the polls are suggesting that if they speak, Bibi and Smotrich and Ben-Gavir will be out of government
And those are the hardliners, and some of the more, described as more extremist elements of that coalition would be in trouble right now. So you have this external pressure from their most important ally. You have this internal dynamic that is playing out in Israeli politics. And Netanyahu is trying to respond to the demands of the international community. On that first point you referenced in terms of allowing more aid in, temporarily opening a port, opening another land crossing, the U.S. has said, that's great to see, but we want to see results before we know if this satisfies our concerns. What do you make of that reaction from the U.S.? And if they could do this quickly, it suggests, John, that maybe Israel could have done this a while ago when the world was saying you need to get more aid in.
Absolutely. There's no question about it. And they should have done it basically because of the image that not doing it has created for Israel around the world, because of the desperate need of the people on the ground. So it should have been done. But I think Biden and company have to be wary. I think that Bibi can open a crossing. Will the trucks come in is a question. He can say that I've done an investigation, and he's demonstrated that some people have lost their jobs. But I think, you know, he should be pressed on a real, transparent, objective, full investigation. And then, as I've said, there are these other issues that are outstanding there. Mm. But for Bibi, it's really trying to stay in power as long as possible and hoping that the polls will somehow turn in his favor, which is unlikely.
We still, it's too early, I think, to say at this point how this may affect their plans for Rafah, because despite the pushback, they have said they still intend to go in there to get the last bastions of the Hamas leadership that exists in the Strip. And on the ceasefire, we know there are going to be talks this weekend that include the head of the CIA, for example, to try to bring it to a resolution. I mean, what is your sense of whether the prospects of that have changed at all with this change in posture by the U.S. and sort of the international reaction, including talks of war crimes against Israel at the United Nations in the wake of what happened with these aid workers?
Well, on the ceasefire, I mean, on the one hand, Biden is putting pressure on Bibi to be more forthcoming and try and do what he can, for example, perhaps allowing Palestinians to return to the north. The other issues are whether it's going to be temporary or permanent, and how many Palestinian prisoners are going to be exchanged for Israeli hostages and what kind of prisoners. So on the one hand, you know, Biden wants Bibi to be compromising. On the other hand, these recent events can give Hamas the idea that they can hold out, that Israel is once again in trouble like they were when the convoy was hit, and that pressure is on Israel so that they don't have to give up. And remember here, it's Hamas that's holding the hostages, and it's Hamas that is allowing the 32,000 Palestinians in some way to have been killed. And it's on the ceasefire, it's a two-way street, and I'm not clear who's putting pressure on Hamas to come to the table as well.
Yeah, that's a very good point in that who gets them to stop the hostilities on their end. John Allen, always appreciate the time. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, David.
Quebec MP Anthony Housefather has decided to stay in the Liberal caucus. Housefather has been reflecting on his future in the Liberal Party for several weeks now, since all but two of his fellow Liberal colleagues voted in favor of an NDP motion on the war between Israel and Hamas. Housefather says his decision came after conversations with the Prime Minister about a new role where he will help defend Canada's Jewish community.
That was really what put me over the tipping point. It was the commitment to a meaningful leadership role in anti-Semitism where the government will really act.
All right, we're going to talk about all of that with the Friday Power Panel. Negan Sinclair is a columnist for the Winnipeg Free Press. The CBC's Jason Markusoff is in Calgary today. And here with me in studio, editorial writer for Le Devoir, Marie Vastel, and the Toronto Star Ottawa Bureau Chief, Tonda McCharles. Okay, Marie, what do you make of this move? How is this going to play in Quebec? Are you surprised he's staying, given Mount Royal has been Liberal since the 1940s? What do you make of this move?
I believe I was here 2 weeks ago and said I would be very, 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 very surprised if he went to the Conservatives. For gestures posed by the Conservatives in the past in that riding, which I think if you're a longtime Liberal like Anthony Housefather, I don't know if you get over them trying to push out your predecessor, Erwin Cutler, who was not, you know, an not respected MP and legal expert. And then there's also all sorts of other reasons why Anthony Hale's father doesn't necessarily agree with the Conservative Party. He's very aligned with them on this conflict and on the unwavering support to Israel. But there's a lot of other issues where I don't think he would. And for the reasons you said, the writing having been liberal since the 40s, even in 2011 when the Liberals had this disastrous election, Mr. Housefather still did, not Mr. Housefather, but the Liberals did still did pretty well. And I truly don't believe Mr. Housefather probably didn't care that much about just getting his seat. I think this is really like a core values issue for him. I would expect that there is a big sigh of relief in the government, PMO, and Liberal circles. Mr. Housefather is respected, even though he's very often dissenting. He's very respected by his fellow Liberal MPs. And, you know, there's always the risk that if one leaves, others kind of follow suit or start thinking about it. So, but I do think, to your point in your interview with him, I think it's going to be difficult because Mr. Housefather is right. The Liberal government's position has slid throughout this conflict.
Yeah.
Less of an unwavering support of Israel and more of a sensitivity to the unproportionality of what is going on in Gaza. And he's also correct when he says we didn't have a big policy debate and you policy paper on the government's position in Israel. It wasn't thoroughly discussed, maybe in caucus, but I doubt it. And so I'm not... He's right when he says there's been all these changes, and I guess he's saying no one talked to us about it. Hopefully he does get to have his voice heard within the government, because there's a lot of people who also agree with this sliding of position of the government.
Right. And Tanda, you know, he said he got conversations with the prime minister multiple times, it sounds like, with the deputy prime minister, and he said those were central to him staying. But this issue of Israel, which is the one big bit of disagreement between him and the caucus on this, that is not going to go away. We've seen the UK shift positions this week, the US shift positions.
No, if anything, you know,
it's going to get harder.
Still, it's still set to be a longer conflict than perhaps anyone thought last fall, and it's still set to be a very tough one. Look what happened this week with the killing of the humanitarian aid workers. That has brought on some much more difficult conversations at the leader level as well. So, no, it's not going to be an easy road for Mr. Housefather, given where he stands on it. But look, I think that the Liberal caucus may be heaving somewhat a sigh of relief to keep him in there. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, when this whole motion that triggered his angst was voted on, that whole day we were hearing that, you know, 50 up to 70, perhaps 80 MPs might have voted on the other side of it. So offside with Mr. Housefather. Yeah. So he's still got, you know, I guess a big job to persuade his own caucus to hold fast to their support of Israel. I think that that's just like the government, the cabinet's position has shifted. The caucus position is very tenuous, right? So I don't think it's easy. But you know, the fact that they're offering for him to do domestic anti-Semitism work with the envoy Deborah Lyons, I don't know that that gives him, you know, the kind of impact that he hopes to have on this issue, because that envoy office really hasn't done much to stem the rise of anti-Semitism.
But it might be the only impact he can have in a caucus where the Liberals represent 23 out of the 25 ridings with the biggest Jewish population, same proportions for Muslim population. They're so torn that it's probably the biggest impact he can have is on domestic anti-Semitism.
But, you know, Nigam, when you look at the math of this, and I know we've had the public reflection by Anthony Housefather and ultimately deciding to stay, but to Tanda's point, had that motion gone ahead unamended, it could have been a real visceral split inside the Liberal caucus. And this is just shows the efforts that they have to go through to keep everything together as this conflict rips apart the country in many ways.
There are some ridings where even the wording, while watered down for this motion, came through in, you know, supporting the movement towards the state of Palestine or a potential two-state solution. It just won't serve in other ridings. I happen to be sitting in the riding where the other dissenting Liberal MP, Ben Carr, and in this riding, you would... Nothing recognizing anything looking like a two-state solution is even a rational discussion in conversations over here. In this particular area, similar to Housefather's riding, there is not a lot of movement or interest in being able to to discuss a solution to this beyond just some of the real visceral outcomes that's coming forth. And so it's a real tricky move, I think, for the Liberal caucus to try to balance on this issue while still being humanitarian on it. I think the Liberals have done maybe the best they could do in terms of trying to just play it in such a way that they're thinking in a humanitarian way of what we can do, because this crisis is getting to the nth proportions, and it's coming to a point in which we're seeing not only aid workers being killed, but we're also seeing thousands, hundreds of thousands of people who are suffering starvation on a daily basis in Gaza. And it's a crisis that is on the global proportions that everyone is looking at. And so it's very hard to continue in this pattern to be able to look to anything other than maybe even recognizing that there is rights to be considered other than Israel's right.
So, Jason, it's interesting that, like, you know, we follow the political reflections of one member of parliament, you know, from one riding in Canada. But, you know, the global politics on this is shifting this week in a profound way with Joe Biden basically saying to Bibi Netanyahu, you've got to do this differently or we may not have your back anymore. And then Benny Gantz, who's part of the war cabinet in Israel, saying we need to have elections earlier because of the political situation there. This is going to be a more tenuous issue for this government to deal with, given the fault lines in this country. And it seems to me some difficult moments ahead for Anthony Housefather, despite his decision to stay today.
Yeah, I'm not sure if we've seen some of the more firm, passionate advocates, either on the pro-Palestinian or pro-Israel side, shifting as much as some of the more broad, broad-based politics have in this. I don't know if you hear that, like I said, on either side. It's quite interesting that Mr. Housefather, I wonder if he decided or thought about, what can I do in this next term? I mean, I'm not sure if he's not sure if there's clarity on whether he's running again, but options would have been to stay in the Liberal caucus and try to advocate and persuade, the ministers and government policy and be in the governing caucus, which will be deciding things from here till the writ, or go on to the Conservative side, deliver a massive political blow to the Liberal Party, and send a very strong signal to particularly Jewish voters, perhaps also Anglo-Quebec voters, which is another prominent group that he's been a staunch advocate for, often occasionally offside with the Liberals on. If he went to leave like that would be difficult. Also, it would only mean he was an advocate. He'd only be advocating, criticizing. And what's also interesting, though, is that a lot of the points that he mentioned in his statement, talking about support for business, support for robust foreign policy with traditional allies, those were core values that often the conservatives wouldn't feel too offside about. He didn't mention some of the things like, housing affordability issues necessarily, or certainly nothing on, climate or energy, which are some of the larger wedges there. So I wonder if, ideologically he's not, he may have more alliances with the liberals, because what he was talking about in your interview was kind of these classic liberal, more moderate positions. And a lot of those have not been, where Justin Trudeau has taken the party. He's, tried to claim more of the left of center ground with much of his things. I mean, he doesn't, this was a mention of balanced budget that I haven't heard the liberals talk about much in quite a while.
Yeah. Sorry, Nigan, you wanted to jump in?
I was just going to add in, he started using terms like balanced budget. So he did mention some stuff around affordability and austerity, around some of the issues around economy.
Yeah, fiscal sustainability. I can't remember the exact phrase, but Tanda, a lot of what he was saying he was staying to advocate can be read as like a little bit of a criticism of things.
Or a warning.
Like, yeah, it's like almost like I'm one of the few centrists left in this party. We can't be the NDP light. That's kind of what it sounded like.
Yeah,
could be interpreted
as a bit of a poke. I think he wants to retain some influence and not look like he just caved and on a decision that must have been a tough one. But I think, we're also missing some of the other political considerations here. I mean, he had to be concerned when Pierre Poilievre went into his own riding, into a synagogue, and spoke to hundreds of people there and got a rousing reception from the Jewish community in that riding. So I think, he wants to still be a bit of a thorn in this government side. He still wants to speak to them about how I think maybe I don't know if tenuous is the correct answer, but the correct word. But it clearly this government faces big challenges in keeping the support of the Jewish vote, and that is going to matter in the next election. Look, I mean, whether House Father had gone or not this time round wouldn't have threatened necessarily the Liberal government position. They would have had 155 MPs versus the Conservatives, what, 118 or so. So, you know, in that respect, his staying or going wouldn't have tipped some balance, but it would have tipped, I think, a sense of political importance to this government of that community.
But, you know, on that, Marie, it feels like the Liberals have avoided two real difficult moments over this motion, in that they got an amendment that they could support and get the NDP to support and not have this vote split that Tonda was outlining in their caucus on a pretty key issue of, you know, recognizing a Palestinian state. And they've avoided the loss of an outspoken Jewish MP in the middle of them attempting to take control of the political narrative with this budget rollout. You know what I mean? It's like they've avoided two potential real big problems on this, despite still being embroiled in public controversy. The outcomes weren't terrible for them.
For now. But
yes, for now. Everything is for now on this.
They also almost lost a prominent Liberal MP in Montreal because they amended the motion to try and avoid that 80 other MPs voted for the motion. So I think one is because of the other, not one parallel to the other. And I've been saying this for a long time, and I feel it more and more. I think the simple fact that Mr. Housefather almost even left, someone who says he's been liberal since he's been a teenager, shows just how untenable this sort of middle ground, trying to appease tensions in caucus, but also in society with both communities. It's just not tenable. I'm not saying it's easy. You don't pick one or the other. But it is going to become more and more of a challenge as the war goes on. And Tonda's right. It's clearly not ending anytime soon. And it's not getting any more palatable. Is that the right word?
Yeah.
With everything that's going in, that's just getting worse and worse.
But Jason, it's an interesting exercise in caucus management that we've seen, right? That this level of dissent and public disagreement and reflection from a parliamentary secretary who was not demoted as a parliamentary secretary for voting against this and expressing his disappointment in what his government is doing. They did the outreach to him to keep him on board and gave him a new role that he says he's happy with. I think, you know, when the inside stories of the last couple of months of the Liberal caucus and the conversations comes out, it's going to be quite a fascinating exercise in risk mitigation and caucus management.
I would love to know the level of negotiations or discussions there were between Mr. Housefather and Freeland and Trudeau. I would love to know what kind of conversations he had with some Conservative leaders. If Mr. Poilievre gave him some FaceTime, I'm sure that would have been a delightful victory for him in the political constituency he's really trying to deliver. This is, you know, and let's keep in mind the Liberals are not the only caucus with a mixture of both Jewish and Muslim members who might feel at least privately very differently on this, but it is seemingly the only caucus with open Brooks or at least has open dissent on these issues or open disagreements and opinion on these.
Okay, Nigan, I got to take a break, but I'm going to give the last word to you. What are your thoughts?
I would just add that to be really glass half empty. But I mean, one of the other things here is that we see that the Liberals are able to give Anthony Housefather a way out of this situation, because it was a situation in which perhaps he may have not considered really seriously at all to join the Conservatives, especially with this kind of railing on several different issues that he feels within the Liberal caucus that need to be sort of core Liberal values. And one of the most important motivating factors of all politicians is self-preservation. And I guess it will withstand time to see whether he runs again. But I think he is a longtime politician that would look to also out for himself in this particular riding.
Well, his final answers to me in the interview earlier made it sound like it was either Liberals or the Conservatives, because he said being an independent, which I know some people had advised him to do, he said has no power in the system. You can't speak. He was never going to do that. So, it sounds like the Prime Minister avoided a defection to the official opposition. The inquiry into foreign interference heard hours of testimony this week, and among the revelations we learned, India and Pakistan attempted to interfere in Canada's last two elections, according to newly revealed intelligence documents.
We have detected and reported on some foreign interference activities during those elections. However,
that the head of CSIS issued a burn notice for an intelligence report after meeting with the prime minister's top security advisor. Earlier in the week, former conservative leader Aaron O'Toole said foreign interference may have cost his party as much as 9 seats in the 2021 election.
Nowhere near enough to change the results of the election. But for people in those seats, if they were undergoing intimidation or suppression measures, their democratic rights were being trampled on by foreign actors.
So the goal of this inquiry is to examine possible meddling by China, India, Russia, and others in the 2019 and 2021 federal elections. And here to help us digest this week is former CSIS Director Ward Elcock. Ward Elcock, good to see you again.
Pleasure.
We learned about these interventions made by foreign state actors, India using proxies in undisclosed ways, China trying to get money into the system to help further the interests of people who might support China. Are we any further ahead in understanding the extent of the interference happening here?
No, I don't think most Canadians are much further ahead. Whether the commissioner is or not depends on she's got more access to information than most do. So she may have a different view, and we may learn she has a different view. I don't think we know very much more about foreign interference than we did before. I'm not sure that we really have seen any indication of serious foreign interference that affected the elections. Although the issue of foreign interference is clearly an important issue for a lot of Canadians.
Right. So we should parse that a bit, because there is the issue of foreign interference. We've heard from diaspora communities feeling pressure in their communities to just do certain things, having economic consequences for them and social consequences for them. And then there's the meddling in the electoral process.
Yes.
And my sense of it is we've seen definite evidence it's happening. It's being attempted, but I've not yet seen something definitive, and I'm not trying to downplay the significance of saying this action had this political consequence and changed these results. What's your sense of what we've seen?
It's not clear that any of the actions that any of the players have taken so far have really influenced any particular election, and not necessarily any particular riding. Mr. O'Toole made the case that he'd lost 9 seats as a consequence of foreign interference. I'm sure he believes that, and he has a rationale for it. He tried to explain it, but the reality is it depends on a bunch of assumptions that I'm not sure are entirely accurate in terms of what the Chinese community did or didn't do in terms of the election and why it voted and didn't vote.
So there's a couple of things we've seen, though, that show the extent of the attempt at minimum, right? Whether the outcome was affected or not, like we saw a document presented.
Yes, relatively minimal interference, relatively minor in actions, if you will.
Okay, so one of those, maybe this is minor, I don't know, but there's some suggestion, or Chinese officials may have transferred $250,000 to threat actors in Canada to try to affect up to 11 campaigns, work with a bunch of different staffers and volunteers working on these campaigns. What do you make of this revelation that Chinese money was coming in some way? There's no definitive proof it went to the campaigns, but it was put into the system somehow to try to influence outcomes.
Well, I don't think it's actually clear how much was put in or whether any was in fact put in. All of this is... I think it was a conservative political activist said at one point, we never get, in all the discussions we had about foreign interference, we never got any actionable intelligence.
Right.
Clearly in this case, even in this case, although there is reporting on this, there's not necessarily any actionable intelligence that allows you to say X got this much and Y got that much and so on and so forth. I guess the other point I'd make is $250,000 spread across God knows how many ridings probably doesn't go very far or buy very much. It's a pretty small effort. I'm not saying it's acceptable. It's not.
Yeah.
And is it something that we should be working against? Yes. But did it affect the election? It doesn't appear that it did.
There's a couple of things we've also heard. One is what David Vigneault was talking about there, the current head of CSIS, about this burn notice, this recall of an intelligence analysis that they issued that he pulled back. And this was after a conversation with a national security advisor in the prime minister's office. There's no suggestion of anything wrong happening there, but there's been some suspicion. People looking at this saying, what exactly does this mean? I mean, you have been in that chair. You've been a CSIS director. How common is it to issue something, a recall like that and a burn notice? And would a conversation with a prime minister or advisor affect your decision-making on that?
No, it wouldn't affect, it certainly wouldn't have affected mine, and I doubt very much it would affect David's view of the world either. That's not the nature of the job. I think the reality is burn notices are not necessarily all that common, but they're not uncommon, I think, as somebody said in the course of the proceedings. Those things happen. A lot of analytical product is produced by CSIS.
Right.
It's produced at a certain level, and it's produced in a kind of continuous stream. So, is it all going through an assessment by more senior people all the way through? Yes, of course it is. Mm-hmm. But when it gets out into a wider community and you have other information and other circumstances, I've seen cases in the past where the information that CSIS has is not actually sufficient to justify the assumption that was made in the analytical piece, and we've had to go back and revisit it. So it's not, this isn't untoward at all.
So it's uncommon, but it's not unusual
No.
for something like this to happen.
No.
Okay. So one thing we also learned is the role of this committee of senior civil servants that has been established to sort of deal with foreign interference during the writ period, the site committee as it's known. And we've seen the issues of Chinese language social media such as WeChat being used to target the conservatives primarily. Kenny Chu has complained about this. Aaron O'Toole has complained about this, saying it was damaging to their campaigns. The officials overseeing that chose not to take action on that or issue a warning on that because they felt it was contained and didn't necessarily have proven foreign acting motivations behind it, and it may not influence the outcome of the election. We saw today, though, that they did reach out to Facebook to take down a defamatory false story about Prime Minister Justin Trudeau during the election campaign because it was in English, could go viral, and in their view could affect the outcome of the election. There's complex risk calculations going on in both of those. How do you think what we've learned there shows how the country is dealing with this and what they might need to do in terms of assessing these sorts of actions in the future?
Well, perhaps we'll get something from the commissioner on that will be useful. Time will tell. I'm not so sure, but we'll see. I think the reality is, and you can see it in the discussions around the 2019 election, the 2021 election, yeah. There's a development in terms of how the bureaucrats are approaching the problem and how, to some extent, they're trying to deal with the parties. So this is a learning experience. It didn't exist in my day. We didn't have any right. conversations at all with anybody. So it's a learning experience. And this is not easy stuff. Because as one of the conservatives, as I said earlier, one of the conservative people who was interviewed by the commission said, a lot of what we heard was not actionable. Well, the reality is if it was actionable, probably the RCMP would have taken action.
Right.
Or CSIS would have taken action to prevent the activity or to interfere with the activity. And that would have been the end of it. And you wouldn't have had. So basically what CSIS and the other intelligence agencies have is some information that allows them to, as they said, tell the conservatives or the liberals or the NDP or whichever party it is that some things are happening. We think some things are happening. If you see these things, talk to us. And in some sense, until that dialogue becomes more accepted and more common.
Yeah.
And I suspect the political parties are just as leery about talking to the bureaucrats about what they're doing as the bureaucrats are about talking to them about classified information. Until that dialogue actually takes place, there's not going to be much of a really fulsome exchange between right. the political parties and the government officials.
There's one last thing I need to ask you about. There was reporting at the height of this. From Global News primarily, that Handong urged China to not release the Michaels was the allegation that was published because it would keep detaining them or releasing them would be politically injurious to the liberals. And other reporting that this $250,000 was used to finance specific campaigns. We saw intelligence summaries on both of those issues released that say, yes, the Michaels were discussed, but not necessarily in this way. We say, yes, the money was sent to Canada, but it didn't necessarily go to campaigns. How do we reconcile this? There's limits on what reporters can do on national security issues, and there's limits of what conclusions we can draw from intelligence summaries, because you're not seeing the raw stuff. How do we reconcile the extent of all of this with such incomplete sort of issues?
Well, one of the problems we're dealing with here is that a lot of the initial reporting And there have been a number of comments on that by people, well, for example, David Johnson, who said some of the reporting was not, in fact, accurate. So some of the stuff that reporters have seen at some point that purported to be the real thing was not the real thing. Mm-hmm. And so in some sense, that conditions everything that came afterwards, and we all think that what first came out is still true, even if somebody has said it's not right. really true. That makes it very complicated, and I'm not sure it's going to be easy to resolve it. It leaves a lot of questions in people's minds.
All right, Ward Elcock, all of this is complicated. Former Thesis Director Ward Elcock, thanks so much for your time.
A pleasure.
That's it for today. If you like this episode, please follow the pod and catch our next live show on CBC News Network. We're on weekdays at 5 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm David Cochrane. Thanks for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.